This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Basically, what the Sudanese government has done is they've used antiquated land laws to claim that land that has for generations been used by small-scale farmers and pastoralists is unproductive. And they then take it away from them and lease it to these foreign investors who are cash-rich but resource-poor.
That's anthropologist Nasreen Ilamin talking about how small-scale farmers in Sudan have been caught up in the anti-government protests. Details coming up. Also, the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is on the upsurge. And the newly appointed Ethiopian ambassador to the United States talks about the $2 billion in trade with the United States. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, hundreds of Mozambican flood survivors who fled to evacuation camps in Malawi in early March after Cyclone Idai say they are not ready to return home unless they are relocated to higher ground. They say returning to their flood-prone areas would put them at risk should another flood occur, as is happening now from Cyclone Kenneth. In the meantime, they are appealing to Malawi's government to reconsider its decision to close down evacuation camps in May. But government authorities in Malawi say their resources are limited. Lamek Masina reports from Bangula evacuation camp in Sanji district.
Rute Joseph and her four children fled Cyclone Idai flooding that damaged her house and washed away property in Zambezia province in Mozambique. Having stayed at Bangula evacuation camp for nearly 2 months, Joseph, a single mother from Murombola village, says returning is not what she wants. She says although they have received reports that water has now subsided in their area, the problem is that the area experiences flooding every year. Therefore, she is not willing to return. Several other of the 1,000 Mozambican flood survivors at this camp, like Joseph Mateu, say they will return home only if government will move them to higher ground. He says life at the camp is problematic. They survive on a small food donation from organizations, but still they don't have plans to return home because they don't have anything to start with back home to rebuild their lives. However, Malawi government authorities say they don't have enough resources to continue keeping people in camps. Michael Jimbalanga is the commissioner for Sanje District in southern Malawi.
You know that as government, when we are planning, we look at the proportion that we have in the district. And the coming in of this Mozambique, it means they have wasted our budget, which was very small. And the coming in of these people, it means we are constrained, knowing that the resources are now going to a larger number of people.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, is currently distributing tents, sleeping mats, blankets, and other startup items to Cyclone Idai victims, including Mozambicans. Valentin Tapsoba is the regional director at UNHCR in Southern Africa.
As a UN Refugee Agency, Protection Agency, International Protection Agency, we cannot also leave them aside. But we are not only assisting the Mozambican, we are assisting and the Mozambican and the people from Malawi. This, I want to be clear, that we are not discriminating.
In March, Cyclone Idai killed over 1,000 people and damaged many houses across Mozambique, Zimbabwe and Malawi. The arrival of a second storm in Mozambique, Cyclone Kenneth, has reinforced Joseph and Mateo's fears of returning home. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Nsanje.
The United Nations Human Rights Chief says thousands of lives are at risk because of the growing conflict in Libya. The office of Michelle Bachelet said today that she has grave concern that thousands of civilians are trapped in conflict zones in or near the capital, Tripoli. Bachelet also expressed concern over the 3,350 migrants and refugees held in detention centers near Tripoli. Some of these people face shortages of food and water. Bachelet says the refugees also face being forced to work for the militias controlling their detention center. The UN has called for a ceasefire in the struggle between the internationally recognized government in Tripoli and the Libyan National Army, LNA, led by Commander Khalifa Haftar, whose fighters are approaching Tripoli. In recent weeks, the offensive of Haftar's LNA has slowed as resistance to his advance from the eastern part of the country increases. The UNHCR says 42,000 people have been displaced since fighting started in early April, and many civilians are trapped, afraid to leave their homes. Although the UN has urged a stop to the hostilities, disagreement among European and Arab states has hurt efforts to reach a ceasefire. Foreign media have focused mainly on the role of youth, women, and professionals in the ongoing struggle for democracy in Sudan. However, many small farmers and pastoralists are also making their voices heard. They say they have been deprived of their land by ousted President Omar al-Bashir and his predecessors. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nasreen El-Amin, a Sudanese writer and diaspora activist living in the New York area. Her work has appeared in the Washington Post and other outlets. El-Amin is also a doctoral candidate in anthropology at Stanford University, specializing on the ways that foreign land seizures affect rural people in central Sudan.
Well, Sudan is sort of at the heart of what many people have called a land rush that sort of emerged in 2008 in response to the financial and food crisis. There are about 32 large-scale deals that were struck between Sudanese government elites and mostly Gulf investors, so Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, but also Egypt, Jordan, Turkey.
How did that happen?
Basically, what the Sudanese government has done is they've used antiquated land laws to claim that land that has for generations been used by small-scale farmers and pastoralists is unproductive. And they then take it away from them and lease it to these foreign investors who are cash rich but resource poor.
Did these farmers get kicked off their land?
There wasn't necessarily mass-scale displacement as there has been in other parts of Sudan, but people's livelihoods were essentially taken away, and they've been using civil disobedience protests, they've been organizing to reclaim land.
So along with women and youth and many urban types in Khartoum, these farmers have also become an interest group that's rooting for a change in regime.
Absolutely. Traditionally, where I do my research, used to be a stronghold of the regime, but because of these land grabs, people have really turned against it. And so, you know, one of the things that's obviously going to be a question is, will these land deals be honored? Can they be reversed because they were illegal to begin with? And, you know, some of this also has to do with the fact that the Sudanese government has been sending troops to support the Saudi coalition's war in Yemen.
But at the same time, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are pledging their support for the Transitional Military Council. Why?
In part, I think, because they're trying to protect their investments.
So as an anthropologist, what's your take on all this?
So I think as an anthropologist, my role is really to speak to people about the ways that they're experiencing land dispossession. Not everybody gets impacted in the same way. You have women, for example, being dispossessed in a different way because of inheritance laws. You have landless people who have been living off the land who can't really claim rights to that land through the courts, right? So part of what I'm looking at is in what ways does struggling through the legal system exclude certain kinds of people? In particular, the Jazeera, where I study, has a large group of landless workers who came when the British first created the Jazeera scheme, which was the largest centrally managed irrigation scheme in the early 1900s, a lot of them were already pilgrims going to Mecca, and so they stayed and they worked there, and they've been there ever since, but they don't really have the option of claiming rights to that land through the courts. Also pastoralists, they're experiencing this in a very different way. They're in some ways the biggest losers in all of this because they need access to much larger areas of land, and a lot of these deals essentially give investors land that they then cordon off and secure. I've lived with people who are pastoralists who try to enter into the farms through these holes, and they get shot at. The police comes and confiscates their animals, and they have to pay per cow to get their animals back. And so that's created tensions between the kind of more landholding stakeholders and these landless stakeholders. So I look at some of those tensions.
And of course, in your work, you pointed out that Sudan has a very long history of these so-called land grabs.
Yeah, you know, I think about land grabs not just as they started in 2008. There have been colonial land grabs, and there was a period in the 1970s when Gulf investors tried to turn Sudan into the breadbasket of the Middle East. And I am looking at the way that land during both the Ottoman Empire and the British Empire, if you will, got consolidated in the hands of the elites, right? And that happened partly through slavery. So I look at the role of slavery, which didn't end until the 1950s. You have people of enslaved descent who can't inherit land. So you've got these historically layered levels of land dispossession, and what the protesters are demanding is not just a fall of this regime, but a dismantling of the political and legal system that has put this regime in power. And these international actors play a role because they invested a lot of money in Sudan, and none of it has benefited people. And that needs to change in the post-revolution period.
That was anthropologist Nasreen Ilamin speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. 17 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Hundreds of Mozambican flood survivors who fled to evacuation camps in Malawi say returning home to their flood-prone areas would put their lives at risk. And farmers and pastoralists in Sudan say they have been deprived of their land by ousted President Omar al-Bashir and his predecessors. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo has intensified after a pair of attacks on medical workers disrupted the fight to bring the outbreak under control. The DRC's health ministry said in a statement today that 26 deaths from confirmed cases were reported Sunday in the northeastern North Kivu province, the most in a single day of the outbreak that began last August. The ministry counts 957 deaths in the country so far, 891 cases are confirmed, while 66 others are suspected. Ebola is a highly contagious and deadly disease. The virus has caused 33 deaths among healthcare workers treating patients. The World Health Organization's most recent report count 1,353 cases. That means more than half of those infected die of the disease despite an effective vaccine and new treatment drugs. The current outbreak is the DRC's 10th in 40 years. Infections first appeared in North Kivu and spread to the Ituri region. Adding to the hardship of aid workers has been a series of attacks against teams fighting the disease. On April 19th, a Cameroonian doctor working for the WHO was shot and killed. Two others were injured in the attack. Health workers have threatened to go on strike if security isn't improved. In spite of the violence, WHO's chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus promised to continue his group's efforts. "We will finish our work," he said. These are the circumstances under which South Africa's national election will happen in early May. 10 million people unemployed, a national debt of more than 3 trillion rand or $200 billion. Collapsing state-owned enterprises such as the National Electricity Utility, whose failure to keep the power on is costing the country billions of dollars. Political parties sowing racial discord in a country still haunted by its apartheid past. In Johannesburg, Darren Taylor has asked three of South Africa's most respected political minds, is this the country's most important poll since its first democratic vote in 1994?
The analysts agree that if the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, had not replaced Jacob Zuma as its leader in late 2017, the election would have seen its support plunge even further. Zuma's administration was characterized by corruption and mismanagement, and the ANC was voted out of power in three cities in the 2016 local government polls. Professor Stephen Friedman is the director of the South African Center for the Study of Democracy.
It's probably the first election since 1994 in which the election result is in serious doubt. And that, of course, makes it the most interesting election since 1994.
Zuma's replacement, Cyril Ramaphosa, has been clawing back support for the ANC. Surveys indicate the party will get enough votes on May 8th to hold on to power and to fend off its main rivals, the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters. Former ANC MP and political observer Melani Verwoerd says the election result is important because of what it could trigger within the ruling party.
It's for Cyril Ramaphosa to be able to deal with a lot of the problems that he's facing in his own party. So yes, it's absolutely crucial, particularly for him to show that he has a big public mandate that will secure his position for the next 5 years, possibly for the next 10 years.
University of Johannesburg Vice Chancellor Adam Habib says the poll is about whether South Africans trust Ramaphosa when he says he wants to cleanse the government of corruption and inefficient ministers. Habib thinks Ramaphosa's ANC needs to win by at least 60% to prevent Zuma loyalists in the party from stifling his reform attempts.
The question is, how do you get the balance right? And will the balance be struck simultaneously to give Cyril enough of a decisive wing for him to act against the corrupt influences in the party, whilst at the same time enabling a platform to be built that will allow for the checks and balances to emerge within South Africa's political system?
He says a sweeping win for the ANC could be a double-edged sword. A big victory helps Ramaphosa to make positive changes, but, he says, it also ultimately harms democracy and sets the scene for a possible repeat of the Zuma era, during which an all-powerful ANC had free rein.
You need a strong opposition. A party does not deliver because it is a great party or because its individuals are great human beings. A party delivers towards inclusive development and democracy when there are checks and balances. Politicians deliver because of the threat of losing. That creates the accountability dynamic.
Friedman says potentially millions of people no longer trust the ANC because of its failure to govern properly under Zuma. He adds that voters' lack of faith also could be a problem for the opposition Democratic Alliance, which appears to be racked with infighting.
Therefore, I think this election will fundamentally be about trust rather than particular issues. Land, what ought to be done about the economy. 99% of voters have made up their minds on those issues long ago.
Friedman says party loyalties remain strong in South Africa, and it especially won't be easy for ANC supporters to dump the only political home they've known. Nevertheless, he says, the ANC should be worried that its members will punish it for the corruption and stagnant economy under Zuma. For now, the parties are desperately trying to sell their messages to a skeptical public. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
V- The newly appointed Ethiopian ambassador to the United States, Fusuma Ragga, sat down with me for his first interview as a diplomat, where, among other things, I asked him to talk to us about U.S.-Ethiopia relations and American investment in that country.
The relationship between Ethiopia and the United States has elapsed a century. We are in the second century, more than 115 years. When we see our diplomatic relation, when we see the potential in terms of wealth and entrepreneurship skill that U.S. has, and the natural resources and the endowment Ethiopia has, I think there is little that has been done. And there is a great opportunity that we need to work together to tap that opportunity. Just to give you a figure, total investment, or trade, I better say, between the two countries in 2018 stands out not more than $2 billion. That's the total.
$2
billion. I mean, when you compare this with a figure that we had 10 years ago, it has increased by tenfold.
Yes.
Because of the AGOA opportunity and some of the U.S. investments like PVH that invested in industrial parks and exporting 100% to the U.S. market. And there are other industry manufacturing companies in footwear, in clothing, and flower farms, coffee, and other products that are exported to the U.S. But again, yes, the value addition in some traditional goods is not that much good. We need to work hard on that and also expand more. I believe Africa is the next frontier for manufacturing in the world, because it was the West, then moved to the East. Now it makes sense to do business only in Africa when it comes to labor-intensive industries. And Africa is the last frontier. Unless we do our best in Africa, unless we do our best in countries like Ethiopia, where close to 70% is used, it's not, you know, it will be too late, and it's sad. So we have to use this opportunity now.
Now that you mentioned the youth, is there an effort by the government, your government, to open up space for young entrepreneurs in the field of technology back home?
Yes. For technology to grow, we need to improve connectivity. There are some projects going on, but as a country, we need to invest more on connectivity. You can see just in a short time when Madagascar improved its connectivity, it's creating a lot of jobs for the youth. We have to improve the connectivity, and the youth will take care of the other. There are huge IT-related job opportunities in addition to software development and others, but there are also outsourcing companies that are looking for an alternative, way of doing things from Europe and U.S.
That was the newly appointed Ethiopian ambassador to the United States, Fusuma Ragga. He spoke to me from our VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. And thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa.
VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.